It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, outdoor adventurer Emily Ford shares her winter expeditions on the Ice Age Trail and across the Boundary Waters. First, Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and John Kennedy introduced new legislation today to designate 9 Mexican drug trafficking groups as terrorist organizations. Graham said the bill would set the stage for the U.S. to use military force if necessary. The push comes in response to growing concerns over fentanyl and other drugs flowing into the country from Mexico and a recent kidnapping of 4 U.S. citizens in Mexico that left 2 dead. The latest proposal to combat the dangerous opioid problem that spanned multiple administrations with no clear end in sight. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the flow of fentanyl and other drugs in the United States? Is there a solution you'd like to see us try? Has fentanyl been a problem in your life, with your family, in your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Vonda Feldbaum-Brown is a senior fellow in the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She's their director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors, co-director of their Africa Security Initiative. Vonda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's first of all talk about the role of fentanyl as part of the drug mix in the United States. We've talked a lot on the show about fentanyl in Wisconsin. Nationwide, how big a part of the problem are fentanyl and other synthetic opioids?
Synthetic opioids are generating the most significant and devastating drug crisis ever in the U.S. history and arguably globally, as they have spread throughout Canada and are spreading in Mexico. And it's only a matter of time when other regions of the world, like Europe and Asia, will also become hit by them. They are simply more lethal than any other drug. And in the United States, they are the most devastating drug. We are finding fentanyl use not simply mixed, in use with heroin, but today also with cocaine, with methamphetamine. Even though it's an absolutely devastating drug because of the lethality, the potency per weight, it's a drug that traffickers really like because it's so easy to smuggle because of how lightweight it is, how potent it is per weight. So a terrible problem.
I know smuggling of a drug like fentanyl is a moving target. What do we know about the most common way that fentanyl makes it into the United States?
So over the past 3 years, really, since 2019, 2020, when China legislated as a result of U.S. pressure, that the entire class of fentanyl-type drugs is what's called scheduled, can only be sold and exported and produced with special licenses, the trade follows the following path. China is the principal source of so-called precursor chemicals. They are the chemicals from which fentanyl is made. The second supplier is India, but China is the dominant one. These precursors are sold by Chinese traders and traffickers to Mexican criminal groups. They are imported to Mexico as precursor. And then the Mexican cartels, principally the Sinaloa cartel and cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion, supervise their cooking, the chemical process by which the precursors are turned into finished fentanyl. And then the Sinaloa cartel and cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion are the principal wholesale suppliers to the U.S. A lot of the drugs, most of the drugs cross through legal ports of entry, hidden in cargo, in legal cargo, hidden in special compartments of cars. But they can also be flown across the border by drones, and they are also brought in by boats that land in California, for example. Now, some of the drugs come as fentanyl, as powder. Others are pressed into pills, often fake oxycodone pills, and are brought across the border in that form.
It sounds like a much easier drug to make than, say, if you had to grow a crop, a poppy field to make a heroin. Is this process making it much easier to produce and then transport opioids?
Absolutely. and you get it exactly right. That is a synthetic drugs revolution sweeping the world. Synthetic drugs are much easier to produce. And that is also the case because one does not have to control territory. So if you are a supplier of cocaine or heroin, you need to control substantial territory on which to cultivate opium poppy or the coca plant from which then cocaine and heroin are produced. For synthetic drugs, small labs that are easily hidden in the cellar of a house can produce vast quantities that supply large areas, cities, even countries for a considerable amount of time. And this is especially true about synthetic opioids. So there are other synthetic drugs like methamphetamine that are potent and devastating. That's the drug of choice in East Asia and Asia Pacific, for example. In the United States, we have significant problem with methamphetamine that's also produced in Mexico. But synthetic opioids are so potent that so little amounts of them supply the entire market that they give tremendous advantage to traffickers. It requires very few labs to produce them, small labs. The chemistry is not particularly complex. And since the amounts of both precursor and the finished product are very limited, it's very easy to hide them in cargo. Now, by some estimates, it takes several trailer trucks full of cocaine and heroin to supply the US market. And by several, I don't mean 100, but in the sort of single 10, 20 digits in numbers, single or double digits. For fentanyl, we are really talking just a fraction of that. So very small amounts can supply the country, but also devastate lives. And consequently, hiding the cargo is very easy.
Talking to Vonda Fell, Bob Brown with the Brookings Institution, expert on the international drug trade there. You can join in our conversation about fentanyl, where it's coming from, how to stop it, where to stop it at the border, at its point of origin, in the demand side. Join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Vonda, I mentioned some members of Congress floating the idea of declaring the organizations that are producing and transporting these drugs in Mexico as terrorist organizations. You've written about this idea before. You have concerns, I think. Can you tell us what that would mean?
Yeah, so I fully appreciate why Senator Lindsey Graham and others are concerned about both the flow of fentanyl and its devastating effects. And frankly, the very inadequate state of cooperation from the Mexican government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador with U.S. law enforcement efforts. Clearly, the U.S. government needs to strongly demand far stronger action from the Mexican government that, since López Obrador came to power, really withdrew from the cooperation very substantially. And that, in my view, might also mean getting tough with Mexico. That said, I don't think that the terrorist designation is particularly useful. The Obama administration, the Trump administration, all considered that designation and decided not to do it. Currently, the trafficking groups are designed as transnational drug trafficking groups. That gives the U.S. government a wide panoply of tools to use, from interdiction arrests to financial sanctions and anti-money laundering measures, financial intelligence measures. The only additional tool that will become available with the terrorist designation is precisely the one that Senator Graham mentioned, which is the use of military force. Now, the Mexican government is fully opposed to the United States using military force in Mexico. And for the U.S. to do it, it would require essentially declaring a war on Mexico, a country that is enormously strategically important. It's our neighbor, it's our key trading partner, and our communities are deeply intertwined. So this is, obviously enormously diplomatically poisonous and fraud. Second, criminal groups, the cartels, are not like Al-Shabaab. They are not like ISIS. they don't exist in camp. They are not in the middle of a desert or in the middle of the forest like the leftist guerrillas in Colombia, the FARC that are implicated in the production of cocaine. There are no obvious targets that a US drone strikes, for example, would hit. And even if you can identify the target, its impact would be very limited. Much more robust interdiction efforts that seek to dismantle much of the operational layer of the cartel are far more useful. And finally, the terrorist designation comes with significant constraints on US policy. The United States cannot engage in any way with any entity that provides material support to a terrorist group. That includes no financial, humanitarian, economic assistance. What would this mean in Mexico? For example, the cartel stacks legal commodities that are shipped to the United States, avocado, corn, grain, citrus, fish. If we designate the cartels as terrorist groups, we would probably have to face legal pressure not to be engaging in any of these imports because the cartels economically benefit from it. Or the United States could not provide any kind of alternative livelihoods assistance socioeconomic anti-crime assistance to the parts of Mexico where the cartels operate, which is all of Mexico, if the Mexican authorities could not assure guarantee that none of the economic aid would trickle to the cartels, which they cannot. So the situation in Mexico is very, very serious, and the administration of López Obrador has more or less abdicated for the past 4 years any kind of meaningful anti-crime policy. But the way to get out of that problem for us and for the Mexican people and Mexican government is not the designation.
We're talking to foreign policy expert Vonda Felbaugh-Brown from the Brookings Institution about the international drug trade and the flow of fentanyl in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where would you like to see efforts focused on stopping the flow of fentanyl? On the demand side, helping people avoid addictions maybe in the first place, more border security, more searches of those vehicles coming in at points of entry in Mexico itself. What questions do you have? What experiences have you had in your community, maybe your family, with the impact of fentanyl? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Vonda Felbaugh-Brown, Senior Fellow in the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, an expert on the international drug trade. With us today to look at how fentanyl and other synthetic opioid drugs flow in the United States, largely from Mexico. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With your thoughts on this issue, maybe your experiences or your questions for our guest, join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hi. I think that, in my opinion, there should be a two-pronged approach. One, our government needs to step up the border inspection and our border patrols. But two, simultaneously, I think our government needs to try to incentivize pharmaceutical companies to develop some sort of a vaccine against fentanyl, its psycho effects on the brain, hallucinogenic effects, and incentivize them with a pretty sizable prize, a $1 billion prize for the first company that can develop gotcha. Some sort of a vaccine.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take those one at a time, Vonda. First of all, more inspections at the border. You were talking about the challenges of finding fentanyl. A lot of vehicles cross from Mexico into the United States with legitimate trade and other purposes. Are there things you think we could do, though, Vonda, to make the border more secure when it comes to fentanyl coming in?
Well, we have several decades across multiple administration, both Republican and Democratic, that have made a lot of effort to strengthen the border, both on our side in modernization, putting in more inspection equipment, as well as on the Mexican side, or trying to induce the government of Mexico to do so. One of the controversial issues actually right now is the effort by the Mexican government to try to buy Chinese technology for the border inspections, where we have legitimate strong fears this could be used by the Chinese government for spying in the US. However, there is also recognition, obviously, that the border is not just a division line. It is also a membrane that needs to allow legal trade, which obviously is very substantial between our two countries, and the legal movement of people. So how to strike the right balance between inspections and catching dangerous contraband such as fentanyl and allow trade is always difficult. And if we had good cooperation with the Mexican government, we could move a lot of that inspection into Mexico. That would be optimal policy. If we had good cooperation, that would allow the U.S. Law enforcement agencies and officials to be present on fentanyl raids, to be part of interdiction of precursors, to be helping dismantle the Mexican drug trafficking groups. Unfortunately, the López Obrador administration in power in Mexico over the past 4 years withdrew all of that, essentially ended all of that cooperation. And so what we are stuck with now is border inspection. And I do believe there is appropriate time now to toughen border inspections, even if that means significantly slowing down the trade from Mexico to the US. This would be painful. It's economically not optimal, but the Mexican government has not shown that it is willing to cooperate meaningfully with other measures that would allow us to avoid this particular policy tool.
And our caller's other point had to do with the demand side of things. Now, I don't know how feasible it is to have a vaccine against the effects of fentanyl, but that said, are there things, Vonda, that you look at when it comes to the public's demand for drugs like fentanyl, where we could treat it there and reduce the incentive to bring this into the country in the first place?
Well, obviously, if we could figure out a way to prevent people from using drugs and developing substance use disorder, we would be in an optimal scenario. This is something that has been called for across many drugs for many decades, and the efforts are still not capable of preventing the devastating epidemic that we are seeing. However, although we don't have a vaccine, we have a very powerful drug, and that's naloxone, that has been crucial in preventing overdose and lethal overdose. So definitely pushing and promoting the availability of naloxone, making it very easy for people, doctors, ambulances, clinic users to access it, it's very important. And this is now becoming more widespread. Just several years ago, this was enormously controversial, with strong constituencies promoting much harsher approaches to dealing with drugs, strongly opposed to that, believing that allowing overdose, reversing medications like naloxone would worsen the situation. There is some experimentation with places where users can inject and use safely. One of them is, for example, in New York. Those safe injection sites are part of a broader approach that's called harm reduction. Still remains very controversial in the U.S., much more advanced and accepted in places like the Netherlands, Britain, Switzerland. I believe there is a strong role for the harm reduction approaches as well. But we are sadly in a situation where 6 years ago, users would be asking for heroin, and they would be unhappy if they were given fentanyl. Many of the established heroin opioid users that develop addiction either to heroin or first to pharmaceuticals and through them to transition to prescription drugs and heroin were not happy with the presence of fentanyl. This has now changed. Unfortunately, users are actively seeking fentanyl, despite the fact that it is so prevalent. And there are, of course, still very many unscrupulous dealers that are mixing fentanyl into, as I mentioned, also cocaine and methamphetamine. So we are nowhere close to solving the demand issue. There is no magic bullet for it. And while demand reduction and treatment measures need to be robustly funded, enabled, we need to be willing to experiment with, and more than experiment, even embrace policies such as methadone maintenance. It's not a silver bullet alone that's out there. Tackling supply side is also important.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Vonda, you know, there's not one magic solution here, but we started off talking about Congress. If Congress could do one thing and get it signed by the president, what would you like to see the priority be?
On the demand side, it would certainly be expanding availability of treatment in many different forms, including making it possible for safe injection sites. And expanding methadone maintenance. On the supply side, I would like us to not move toward the foreign terrorist group designations, but to have robust legislative capabilities to slow down the border. And frankly, I think a lot of that could be done through executive action. But certainly, Congress plays a role in helping us get to a much sounder migration policy. Currently, U.S. policy in Mexico is frequently held hostage to migration. This was the case during the Trump administration and continues to be the case during the Biden administration, that the Mexican government threatens larger flows of migrants, allowing more undocumented people from Central America to come. If we have a migration reform and legal access to jobs, we can be much tougher on the border with respect to fentanyl.
Thanks to our guest, Vonda Felbaugh-Brown with the Brookings Institution, joining us for a look at the flow of fentanyl and other drugs into the U.S. from Mexico. Coming up, an outdoor adventurer shares her winter trek across the Ice Age Trail in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says we can teach kids to listen with more empathy and tells us why she thinks it could be part of a civics curriculum. Now, through hiking the Ice Age Trail, all 1,200 miles of it is a feat. Doing it in winter, that's even more impressive. Emily Ford was the first woman of color documented to do just that. She's a backpacker and head gardener at Glen Sheen Mansion in Duluth, Minnesota. WPR talked with her while she was actually on the Ice Age Trail back in 2021. After crossing the finish line, she went on to plan and complete another winter expedition, this time in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. She was on UW-Madison's campus the last few days to screen documentaries that followed both those adventures. The documentaries are called Breaking Trail and A Voice for the Wild. I talked to her yesterday here in the studio. Now, when you last talked to Wisconsin Public Radio, it was when you were still on your way to completing that entire Ice Age Trail in the winter. Let's pick up there. What was it like to actually cross that finish line?
That's crazy. I think I remember my interview, and I remember sitting on my backpack in the middle of the woods and being like, I hope my service is okay. Can you hear me all right? But it was amazing crossing the finish line. As it is for a lot of thru hikers, you hit this moment of, wow, I'm done. I'm so excited. And oh boy, I'm done. Who am I? You know, there's this mix of feeling of being excited, being done, and really going to miss the trail once you're back home.
Now, with this hike and others you've done, other through hikes, you've talked about your adventuring being a contribution to the racial justice movement. Can you connect the dots for people?
Yeah. And it wasn't really an afterthought, but it was like, it was a really good way of seeing puzzle pieces fit together of, this is how I can show up for people of color. This is how I can show up for people of color in the outdoors. This is a way that I can be my true self in a time when race and racism are really, and anti-racism are really on the tips of a lot of people's tongues. I'm not the most vocal political speaking person, but I always tell people that if I can show you what I'm doing and be a face and be a representative and then bring it back home and talk to these, you know, groups of kids or just go out and do talks and talk about my, you know, my experiences in the outdoors as a person of color, that experiential way is a way that I really love showing up.
Yeah, that's part of what you're doing, I think, with your hikes and your documentaries here, being kind of an ambassador to two groups, I'm guessing, to younger people of color, to say, yeah, we can be out in the outdoors, and to everybody else saying, hey, let's make this a welcoming place for everyone. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, for sure. And having it be actually really, really normal for people of color to be outside. I always like to say, like, I'm really ready for the day when I am kind of obsolete in this, where I don't go around and talk about being a person of color in the outdoors, where Emily is old news and there's been tons of other people who have done expeditions who are people of color. I'm super excited for the day that I become obsolete and that so many people have so many more stories to tell, and that it's not really that the limelight is equal to when anybody else goes out and does expeditions, that they're just really cool trips people are doing. And, that there's just a human doing it. You're like, you're also a black person. That's super awesome. But there's also a million other black people now hiking, so you're not as cool as it used to be. Those are the days I'm really, really excited for.
Now, both your documentaries, you got Breaking Trail and then A Voice for the Wild. These aren't just through hikes. These are winter through hikes. I like getting out in the winter for an hour, maybe. What is it about the winter and that long-term trip that is an adventure for you?
Yeah, winter and I really started to become acquaintances more so because I get laid off in the winter for my job. I'm the head gardener at Glen Sheen in Duluth, Minnesota. And in the winter, oddly enough, contrary to maybe popular belief, there's not much gardening to be done for that specific estate anyway in the wintertime. So that's kind of how winter and I became acquaintances. And I started hiking when I moved to Duluth, you know, a little bit longer hikes. I'd done the Superior Hiking Trail. It's 360 some odd miles maybe now, and you kind of get the taste of distance hiking. And for lots of through hikers, the 1,000 miles is really like your first, are you going to do this or are you not going to do this? And the Ice Edge Trail was kind of what the option was. And then I really fell in love with, like, with long distance movement by my own power, or plus with a dog power also.
Now, your trip to Madison that brought you into our studio here is for A Voice for the Wild, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Can you talk a little bit about that trip?
Yeah. Oh, man. For those of you who've never been to the Boundary Waters, it is a beautiful million-acre strip of land between Minnesota and Canada. And it is a space that is wild, and is wild because we protect it, right? So there's a lot of land that is rich with resources, and people have been wanting those resources for a long, long time. And this was, again, a way that I could put my name in the hat of how do I show up for places and people that I really care about. And so, yeah, I got to ski across it. It was 180-mile ski with my dog, Diggins, which people met from the Ice Age Trail. And to show up in a season that people kind of maybe forget that the Boundary Waters exist. There's a niche group of people, a lot of mushers, a lot of fishers, who use the Boundary Waters in the wintertime. But for most people, they are planning their canoeing trips. And I love showing that this place that we love, that people are still working to protect, still exists in the wintertime. And it's really important that we remember this place exists in the wintertime.
Now, for somebody listening thinking, okay, I'd like to do a winter trek. Maybe I'm not going to go 1,000 miles or 100 miles, but you know, a decent outdoor trek. What kind of things do you encourage them to do to start planning for something like that?
Yeah, the question is, are you going to sleep outside? You want to walk outside? Do you want to hike outside? A few things is that people, maybe if they're really new to this, that I've been talking about a lot, is your layering system for your clothes. I always like to describe it as You are a flaky biscuit, and it's nice. You want the layers of thin clothing, so I wear a lot of wool, a lot of merino wool that I can get my little hands on, and then that's the biscuit part, and the warm air that's trapped in between each layer is like the delicious butter that we all love in those biscuits, and it makes for a really nice a nice way to stay warm outside, because one of the biggest things, you don't want to be soaking wet with sweat, because all of a sudden you're having such a good time hiking and enjoying the outdoors, and you're sweating, and you're like, how did this happen? It's minus 20 outside, and it just does happen. So, you know, build up your layers, You don't have to have a huge puffy coat to go hiking in the wintertime. Bring your water with you. Treat it just like a summer hike. Bring your water with you. Bring food with you if you're going to do something for long. If you're going to go somewhere where is a little bit more remote, let people know where you're going. Also, think about how deep is the snow. Do you need a snowshoe? Go ahead and grab some snowshoes. If you've never done that before, there's tons of places around that will bring you out for snowshoe hikes. I'm sure on campus here, they will happily take you out snowshoeing around these places. And if your body doesn't quite move like that, keep poking around and you will find boardwalks that are cleared. And because that's the other thing, is that you don't have to go into these backcountry places to enjoy the winter and enjoy the outdoors. The biggest thing that I always say is, did you get to breathe non-recycled air today? Did you get to breathe air that wasn't coming straight out of the tailpipe of a truck that's going by you? Can you get somewhere that is a little bit out that you can take in the air and maybe hear a few birds or hear the cracking of the ice or hear the snow beneath your feet? That's really what it starts at. You don't have to be an expeditioner to enjoy the winter.
And do you have a next adventure in the planning stages or in the dreaming stages right now?
There's always something coming down the pipe. Next winter, I think I will be hiking the Superior Hiking Trail back in my hometown, and a few other trails connect that. Maybe about 500 miles total is what I'm looking for. But I have to get back out to Alaska. I lived in Alaska this past winter. My partner's getting ready for Iditarod, and so we have to get the... I'm going to be out there helping getting the dogs ready for the 1,000-mile dog race from Willow to Nome.
Wow.
So that will be next winter. And then after that, really, the sky's the limit. You know, there's always an adventure on the horizon.
Emily, thanks so much for sharing your adventures with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That was Emily Ford, a backpacker and thru-hiker in Duluth, Minnesota. She joined me in the studio yesterday. She was on the UW-Madison campus talking about two documentaries that chronicle her expeditions completing the Ice Age Trail and crossing the boundary waters during the winter. Those documentaries are called Breaking Trail and A Voice for the Wild. If you are a thru-hiker and or a winter hiker, love to hear about your accomplishments. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, we'll hear a call to add a new lesson to civics classes for kids, listening with empathy. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You probably had some kind of civics education somewhere in your school career. You might have learned about checks and balances, elections, how a bill becomes a law. But how about listening? Our next guest says that teaching active, empathetic listening in civics classes is key to repairing our democracy, and she has research to back it up. Hillary Conklin is a professor of secondary social studies in the Department of Teacher Education at DePaul University. She got her PhD at UW-Madison. Here's a listen to our conversation. Well, before you became a professor and a researcher, you were in there, a social studies teacher in middle school and high school. How does that experience in the classroom inform what you're trying to find out now?
Yeah, well, I think as I reflect back on my time in the classroom, a couple things stand out. So having been a classroom teacher and spending my days among over 100 adolescents in one day, I think first I have a deep appreciation for the incredible complexity of teaching and how challenging the work that teachers do is. And that complexity and those challenges have certainly only increased since I was in the classroom, and particularly in these last couple years. But then I think something else that being a middle and high school social studies teacher helped me see was how incredibly thoughtful and insightful young people are if we take the time to really listen to them and give them opportunities to share their ideas about the world and their communities. So those are two big things that continue to shape the work that I do now as a researcher and also as somebody who prepares future social studies teachers.
Let's talk about this idea of empathetic listening. You're hoping this is part of our schools, a part of our civics instruction in particular. What is empathetic listening?
Yeah, so this is something my colleague Molly Andalina and I have been thinking about a lot. And the way we're defining it is that, in essence, it's listening to connect. So it's a form of listening that allows people to connect emotionally. It's a form of listening that humanizes other people, and it's also a form of listening that enables all of us to hear more people and more voices that have been historically pushed to the margins. And we're thinking about this in particular as a practice, as you've said, as a practice for civic life. And so we're interested in cultivating empathic listening as a civic skill. And I think it's an important distinction to make that this is not the kind of listening that you might do to maybe find a flaw in somebody else's argument or to prepare for what you want to say in response. So this is not listening for debate, but it's listening to really hear and feel someone else's experience.
Now, before we step into the classroom, let's talk about the need for us for this kind of thing. I guess it's an understatement to say we're not always in our American civic life, not always so good in listening that way. Fair to say?
That is very fair to say.
Now, Project Soapbox is your civics curriculum to go into the class and work in these things. Can you spell out for us? How does it work?
Sure. Yeah, so Project Soapbox is, it's actually a pretty brief curriculum. It usually takes about 1 to 2 weeks, and it's usually implemented in either social studies or sometimes even English language arts classes, typically middle or high school, though it's been implemented in elementary schools as well. And it was developed by an organization, Mikvah Challenge, which is based here in Chicago, and that's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. And essentially, the Project Soapbox curriculum asks students to select what they see as the most important issue that's facing their community, develop a speech about it, and then deliver that speech to their peers. And the curriculum is actually being used in places all over the country, including in Madison, Wisconsin, and in Milwaukee.
When you do this with students, what kind of results do you get? What comes out of this?
Yeah, well, so I referenced before my colleague, Molly Andalina. So she's a political scientist, and she and I have actually done 2 studies on Project Soapbox. And so the first one was in Chicago Public Schools, and we were looking at just a little over 200 students from 9 different high schools. And what we did was we talked with students, interviewed them, we observed their classrooms, we listened to a lot of their speeches. And in this first study, we were really just trying to understand what it was that students learned from taking part in the curriculum. And it's important to say that students often select speech topics that are really personally meaningful to them. And so there were topics ranging from mental health, immigration policy, to racism and gun violence. And something that the curriculum encourages students to do is provide all kinds of different evidence for their topics. And so many, among other kinds of evidence, a lot of the students share personal stories that illustrate the human impact of the issue. And so in this first round, this first study, we found that students developed all kinds of important public speaking skills, they gained confidence, and they also made a lot of gains in their expected political engagement. But what was really most interesting and surprising to us was that the greatest impact of this public speaking curriculum came from students actually listening to each other's speeches. And so that finding led us to a second study where we focused in on the listening piece. And so this time we were in a suburban school district with a much more socioeconomically and demographically diverse student population. So we had a lot more students who were speaking across lines of difference. And we found the same results as in the first study. So in both cases, when students listened to their classmates' speeches, they said, you know, I learned about all sorts of new perspectives that I hadn't heard before. I learned to really value those new perspectives. They said that they gained empathy for others' experiences. In some cases, they said they even changed their perspectives. And they also talked about deepening their sense of connection and trust with one another. And I think a final piece that's important that we found in our study that it helped us think about was that while when a classroom teacher decides to implement Project Soapbox, all students in the classroom end up participating in it and giving their speeches to one another. But part of what's significant about that is that it puts students who've been often historically marginalized in the position to share their perspectives, while those who have greater power in society are in the position to hear those perspectives. And giving that opportunity for all voices to be truly heard, as you may know, is not typically how things operate in our society. So that made it pretty important.
We're talking to Hillary Conklin from DePaul University about the value of empathetic listening in our civics education in our schools. We heard from Ted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ted writes, a few years ago, my wife and I went to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois. An audio exhibit on what people were saying about Lincoln, black people, and the Civil War brought me to tears, realizing we hadn't changed much in those 100 plus years. Ted goes on, if there's a way to awaken empathy in these future adults, I wholeheartedly applaud it. So on a practical level, Hillary, how do you train, say, a junior high or a high school student on empathetic listening, or I guess a grown-up for that matter? What kind of tips do you give them to listen in this way?
Yeah, well, I think it's a great question. And one thing I would suggest is that a curriculum like Project Soapbox really sets up the dynamic to enable this. And part of what we found in our research on Project Soapbox was that you definitely need to create the environment for this to happen. So a teacher needs to build trust, and so there needs to be all sorts of community building that happens in a classroom, and it needs to be a kind of community building where students get to share their values, they get to share what they care about with one another. And then there needs to be a setup in the classroom so that everyone has the opportunity to share their voices, which again is something that Project Soapbox sets up beautifully. Another element of it is people being willing to share these personal stories, which requires getting a little bit vulnerable at times. And that's a lot of what we saw in the Project Soapbox speeches, that students were sharing things that were really personal and important to them. But it's this combination of setting up that community, the community building, so that students feel that they can share those sorts of things with their classmates. And that then sets the stage for sort of building a greater trust in the classroom. So Project Soapbox is one form of fostering this empathic listening, but there are also there are story exchanges, that there are other curricula that are implementing this kind of thing where students are in paired exercises and they share personal stories with one another. So there are a range of different ways that we might approach this in the classroom, but I think the key is building that trust in the community first, so that students then feel like they're in a position where they want to share these important things with one another.
Hillary, if there's somebody listening right now, a teacher, a parent, a student, and they're thinking, yeah, I want this in our schools, how could they reach out and give Project Soapbox or something like it a try?
Well, Project Soapbox is available through the Mikvah Challenge website. So if you go to the Mikvah Challenge, it's MIKVA Challenge, and they have all sorts of tools to connect you to the curriculum. And they're really eager to have more folks do this work. So that's one important tool, I think, is just seeing what curricula are already out there. And Project Soapbox is one great example of it.
Hillary, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hillary Conklin is a professor of secondary social studies in the Department of Teacher Education at DePaul University. She talked to us about teaching empathetic listening in schools as part of the civics education curriculum. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get an up-close look at foster care. Find out how it works here in Wisconsin, then join members of Congress from both parties looking at some changes to federal foster care laws. That's tomorrow morning at 8. You could join the conversation, maybe share your own perspectives and experiences. That's tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. Liam and Emma, Noah and Olivia, William and Ava. If you've needed to come up with a name for a baby in the last couple of years, there's a good chance you picked one of the six names I just listed. Those are the most popular names for newborns in the U.S., according to the most recent data. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to check out some of the biggest names in names and the trends over the years that lead names to rise and fall over time. If you have a story about your name or the one you picked recently for a newborn, we would love to hear about it. What's the name? Where did it come from? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow. One big question. Is Robert due for a long overdue comeback? Name news you can use. This is Central Time.